Join me on my show On Contact, where we interview writers, dissidents, and activists who have been largely blacklisted by the corporate media. It airs Sundays at 12:30 p.m. on KPFK.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles. And thank you for supporting the Pacifica Mission.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. When the Pentagon announced in November of last year that it was ceasing aerial refueling of Saudi-led coalition aircraft operating in Yemen, the move appeared to be a major step back from U.S. support for the war there. However, newly obtained documents had revealed this year that the United States has also been training coalition military personnel from the United Arab Emirates for the air war in Yemen. The files obtained from Air Force's Central Command via the Freedom of Information Act refer to an advanced aerial combat training exercise held for U.S. and allied pilots, which, quote, assisted 150 airmen in challenging exercises to prepare for combat ops in Yemen, end quote. The document goes on to detail additional support provided by the U.S. Air Force's Air Warfare Center at El Dahfra Air Base in the United Arab Emirates. The document stated that, quote, unit fighter personnel advanced the UAE's F-16 fighter pilot training program. Three pilots flew 243 instructor sorties, 323 hours, that created four new instructors and 29 combat wingmen who immediately deployed for combat operations in Yemen, end quote. Yemen is just one of many countries where the U.S. is providing, quote, counterterrorism assistance in its global war on terror that is resulting in the destruction and loss of millions of lives around the world. With us today to talk about the U.S. war on terror and its global impact is our guest, Stephanie Savelle. She's co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. She's also an anthropologist who conducts research on security and activism in the U.S. and in Brazil. She co-authored The Civic Imagination, Making a Difference in American Political Life. Welcome to Middle East in Focus, Ms. Savelle.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can you first discuss why you began mapping all the places in the world that the U.S. was fighting in since the Bush administration launched the global war on terror after 9/11 in 2001, and what you found with respect to the number of places the U.S. is conducting counterterror missions?
Yeah, so the mission of my project at Brown University, the Costs of War Project, is to use research to shed light on the hidden and unacknowledged costs of the post-9/11 wars. So we wanted to put together this map to really give Americans a sense for the scale of what we talk about when we talk about the war on terror. Different administrations have called it by different names. You know, as you mentioned, George W. Bush called it originally the global war on terror, but it's still the same war that has just kind of mushroomed across the globe. What our map shows are 80 countries, and that's 40% of countries in the world. When I first set out to map this, to create this map, I thought that it would include kind of the regular suspects, right? Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, probably a handful of lesser known countries like Somalia and the Philippines. But what I didn't realize was that I was really kind of embarking on a much bigger research process because there's so much of that we're doing overseas in the name of counterterror that just isn't made public. So we really had to kind of comb through government websites and documents. We really looked into a lot of investigative journalism, people who are using FOIA requests and that kind of thing. And then we talked to a lot of experts. So it really became a much bigger project to put all this together.
And, you know, we'll get to the fact that this is all being done in the name of Americans, and that it's all being done with our U.S. tax dollars. And so we'll talk about that in a minute. But before we get there, As a follow-up, where in the world are these counterterror missions happening that surprised you? I know there were places that you had already anticipated, but where are some additional places that was surprising to you in your process of mapping this out? And what exactly is the U.S. doing in these counterterror missions based on your research and what you found?
Yeah. So the biggest surprises were places like Cameroon, Mali, Tunisia, Libya, 14 countries in all where U.S. troops are engaged in ground combat. So a lot of times what this looks like is that the U.S. military is conducting their search and capture missions directed at militant targets. And so we're operating through a variety of mechanisms to do that. One mechanism is a kind of a legal budgetary mechanism called 127E that allows the U.S. military to operate via surrogate forces. So we'll partner with a host country's forces to conduct these raids on these militant targets. And that's the fact that it's happening in 14 countries is really quite astonishing when this really isn't something you hear about until something goes wrong, right? Like in 2017, when the four U.S. soldiers died in Niger, that was exactly what I'm describing. They were seeking out a militant target and the mission kind of went wrong, and that's what led to the four soldiers' death. But you know, the American public and even members of Congress, as we saw at the time, just really aren't aware of anything going on in these countries, much less boots on the ground.
So I want to actually touch on that point. So you said that there are 14 countries where there is actual U.S. forces on the ground engaged in combat, and that even members of Congress are not aware of this. So that means that there hasn't been any formal declaration of war by Congress, right?
Right, exactly. So after 9/11, Congress passed something called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF. And that was something that passed just days after 9/11 when the U.S. was still, reeling from those attacks. And they really grant a lot of authority to the president to wage this counterterror war. And so what's happened is that authority has been used in a lot of cases to conduct these kinds of missions. And Congress has debated very little the expansion of the scope of this war. So, there is a little bit of momentum now in Congress you were talking about Yemen. They were invoking the War Powers Resolution to kind of reassert Congress's right and responsibility to declare war and to have a say in what we're doing, where we are at war. But as a whole, Congress has not debated the extent of the war on terror and the kind of grand plan behind it at all, basically, since 2001.
So, and as you stated, and as I stated in the intro, there's approximately, according to your mapping, 80 countries in which the U.S. is engaged in these counterterror missions, 14 countries where there's actual on-the-ground U.S. forces engaged in combat. So before we get to the countries outside of these 14, could you don't have to list all of them, but could you, again, list some of the major ones where this is happening?
Sure. Well, again, that category includes the usual suspects. So Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria are places where troops are engaged in combat. But there's also Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Somalia, Kenya, the Central African Republic, Niger, Mali, Mauritania, Cameroon, Tunisia, Libya. I have the map in front of me. So that guy kind of hit most of them there, I think.
Do you know roughly how many actual U.S. troops are on the ground in these 14 countries?
I don't. It would be a different research project to figure that out. But what's interesting is that map really outside of the region of the Middle East. The map really focuses on the region of Africa. So there is a lot of counterterror activity going on in Africa, a growing amount in West Africa. We're hearing more about Somalia in the news these days. But that was one of the kind of surprising findings, really, for us, was the extent to which we're doing stuff in that on the that continent, and that's something that we're pursuing in further research.
So can you talk about? I mean, although you have been able to get some information, I imagine that it hasn't been the easiest to get information, just because there's so much secrecy around these counterterror missions that the U.S. is engaged in around the world. Can you talk about some of the challenges you have experienced in collecting this information?
Yeah, the first thing is, a lot of these combat missions are called by the military officially, they're called train, advise, and assist missions. So that's officially what we're doing and on the map it actually shows that we are just doing training in 65 countries of the 80. So that is kind of the broadest category. It's kind of the excuse that the U.S. military uses. And then we really relied on, as I said, investigative journalists who are doing fantastic work kind of on the ground and figuring out, okay, well, they're calling this train, advise, and assist, but actually here's what's really going on. We're operating very closely on the ground in these raids and that kind of thing. So that was an important thing to kind of sort through. And I should note that we only included things on the map that we could really be sure about. So we needed at least two credible sources for each category on our map. So it's actually a quite conservative representation of what is probably a much larger phenomenon, but it's just the things that we were able to kind of find and document in that way. And then there's experts. There's a guy, Adam Moore, he's a geographer in California, actually, who he's looking at U.S. military contractors and kind of tracing the military footprint in Africa via the ways that contracting companies are hiring people and their kind of financials and that kind of thing. So that's a really interesting way of tracking this stuff. It's really just not, you just can't find it on on a regular website anywhere. And I should say one other source that was important for us was the State Department has something that it issues every year called the Country Reports on Terrorism. And that's a report to Congress about kind of the state of terrorism in different countries around the world. And they are not focused on U.S. activities, but they'll mention, U.S. Border Patrol agents were training Border Patrol agents in Argentina because apparently the tri-border area between Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay is a place where the U.S. suspects that ISIS or terror groups are doing money laundering. That's one of the kind of, one of the surprising places, right? Who would think that we were fighting the war on terror in Argentina? Well, actually, we are, training these Border Patrol agents because around this, money laundering thing. And so so the State Department is actually doing a lot of that kind of thing all around the world. So you can, that was another important source of information. And then another category is military exercises. So 26 countries are places where the U.S. military has partnered with local militaries to kind of, military exercises are intended to kind of be a display of American military might and deter enemies, terrorist targets, and kind of bolster local military's capacity. So those are all things, and we only included things where the goal explicitly stated in the news report or the government website or whatever we found said that it was a counterterror mission. So those are 26 26 military exercises that we documented explicitly counterterrorism. There are probably more that we just, we weren't able to document that explicitly.
And with these, specifically these military exercises in 26 countries, is there any documentation with respect to lives, innocent lives that have been lost as a result?
Not from the military exercises themselves. When we are able to track lives that are lost, it's usually via the investigative journalism. When we found information about military exercises a lot of times on, like in local papers, like in Greece, and they're kind of talking about these, and they don't say much, those articles, just that they, this is for counterterrorism purposes and whatever, yeah.
So it sounds like much of the information you've had to obtain through the work of other investigative journalists versus the U.S. government, despite the fact that the U.S. government is using people's tax dollars to pay for all of this. Why do you think there's so much secrecy and lack of transparency with respect to all this, especially considering the fact that it is our tax dollars that are being used to fund all of this?
Right. Yeah. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But I think there's, in the name of security, right, they have a sense that if people know about these missions, then that's going to compromise, the security objectives of the mission or even the capacity of the home countries or the partner countries' military to kind of rout out these terrorist suspects. So they argue that it's a tactical thing, but I think that there really is, here I'm drawing on the network of scholars that are part of the Cost of War Project in saying this, but there really is kind of an overclassification of these kinds of activities. So it becomes a kind of self-propelling thing, right? That things get classified and they don't necessarily need to be. But they are, because that's the way things are done, right? And I think, I think it becomes really hard for especially the investigative journalists who are really well known as publishing this kinds of information, to get any real information from AFRICOM, for example, the command center for U.S. military operations in Africa. So they start to kind of, guard the information ever more carefully as it comes to light as well. And then, if you don't mind, I'll switch to your question about the taxpayer dollars. So again, other research of ours from the Cost of War Project has shown that through fiscal year 2019, we will have spent and obligated $5.9 trillion on the war on terror since 2001. So almost $6 trillion, not billion, trillion, which is just, you can't really even fathom how big that number is. And that is something that we put together that number in part as a response to what the Pentagon says about how much it spent on the war on terror, which they say something like $1.5 trillion, which is still a huge amount. But that, what they're talking about is only what has been appropriated for what are called overseas contingency operations, OCO, that's the name of the funding that goes through Congress. And we say you have to take a broader view. If you're going to talk about how much the war on terror has cost, you have to think about things like the fact that we are caring for a whole generation now of veterans of these wars for the rest of their lifetimes. And this is one of the kind of sickest generations of vets that the U.S. has ever had. And we are paying massive amounts of interest, billions of dollars, in interest already, because these wars have been paid for on a credit card. So we're going to be owing, by the 2050s, we'll owe $8 trillion just in interest. That's outside of the $5.9 trillion that I talked about. We have to include interest costs on the debt, right? And you have to include the ways that the Pentagon budget has been bloated by this war for so many years, this endless war, and the fact that, you know, the prices, like it costs more to recruit people to go serve in war zones, the theaters of war multiple times, right? And all these things that kind of get built into the base budget, and that means that the base budget just grows and grows and grows, the military base budget, just really out of control at this point.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking about the U.S. War on Terror and its global impact with our guest, Stephanie Savelle, co-director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. So one of the things that I think is really important about the research that you all are doing and this mapping project is it's really helping people understand the different ways that the United States actually engages in war. That is not necessarily the traditional ways that I think many people think about. In your research, you found that in 65 countries, the U.S. trains and or assists local security forces in counterterrorism. Can you talk about the significance of this and why it's important for people living in the U.S. to understand the extent and impact of these train, advise, and assist missions?
Yeah. So, again, 65 countries in which we're doing these, you know, training and assisting in counterterrorism. And it might sound like relatively innocuous, right? Like a kind of helping hand in the fight, you know, fight against terrorism, or perhaps a, you know, really sensible, like, let's stop them over there before they get to the U.S. kind of an idea. But the problem is with that is that there are so many different ways, A, that we, you know, we go to these countries looking for terrorists and we get enmeshed in these political, very complex political situations in which we're far over our heads and all of a sudden we're actors in these kind of political battles, and that is, you know, never a good thing to be involved in things that are just completely, you know, out of our purview. And then there's the way that we are partnering with a lot of countries' military and police forces who are known for their abuses, like you know, committing torture, extrajudicial killing, sexual abuse, all kinds of things that have been proven of some of the country's forces that we are partnering with, like, you know, in the Philippines and, you know, other places like that. So what happens is we're helping, assisting and training those kinds of forces, and then they are, and then those countries, a lot of times when we're, you know, working, partnering with less than democratic nations, they're using this kind of framework of counterterrorism to crack down on political opponents and internal dissidents and things like that. So it kind of, you know, it closes the opening for democracy to work, really, when you start calling political opponents terrorists. So there's just all kinds of issues with this, you know, training and assisting that's going on in 65 countries.
Well, and ultimately, you know, the United States is therefore becoming complicit in these human rights abuses that are being committed in other places then.
Well, I mean, ultimately, yeah, it is in some ways because, I mean, also you think about how many times, you know, the U.S., and this is looking historically, but how many times the U.S. is training, you know, countries' forces that then, for example, in Mali, there was a military coup. And who led the military coup? Well, it was someone who had been trained by the Americans in, you know, in military tactics. So there are a lot of ways where our training, you know, it is complicit in those kinds of abuses.
So, and this definitely might be outside the scope of your research and work, but what is, if anything, the role of international law in holding the U.S. accountable in all this?
Yeah, that is kind of outside the scope of what we can do. I mean, we saw just recently, I will say that we saw Amnesty International come out with a really interesting report just a couple weeks ago about civilian deaths in Somalia. So the war on terror has really been ramping up in Somalia recently. There have been dozens of drone strikes just in 2019 alone. And the military, up until this amnesty report came out, said that there were no civilian casualties in these dozens of airstrikes that were, you know, targeting these militant targets. There were no civilian casualties. And that's really hard to believe because drones, what happens is when you're removing the American, Air Force member or whatever from harm's way by having a drone strike, but you're also increasing through the kind of bird's eye view, you're increasing the likelihood or the possibility that bomb would kill a civilian, right? Because the farther away you are, the less you can see on the ground about who's actually there. So Amnesty went into Somalia and did all kinds of interviews and forensic research and figured out that there were they kind of found physical proof that at least, you know, something like 5 people had been killed in a certain time window. But the fact that they actually were able to kind of prove that the military was not telling the truth about this was really important. And then the head of the Africa Command said, okay, well, you know, he ordered a review then of all these drone strikes to see if there had been more civilian casualties than they had said. And they already found 2 documented casualties. So that kind of thing is, you know, a step in the right direction in terms of transparency. But we need, you know, far more of that.
So whether it be these train, advise, and assist missions that the U.S. is engaged in around the world in approximately at least 65 countries and a total of 80 countries that also includes, you know, drone strikes and other type of quote-unquote counter-terror missions, how many lives have been lost in this U.S. global war on terror with the U.S. using all these different methods, like I said, drone strikes, train, advise, and assist missions, et cetera?
Right. So we actually have calculated the numbers of deaths only so far in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's been what we've been able to do. And we had focused on those 3 countries initially because this map is just a recent product of ours, and we've actually been calculating the human toll of the war since 2011. So we have plans in the works in the next year to ramp that up and to include, you know, a global view of all the deaths. But in just those 3 countries, again, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, we've shown that we have killed about 500,000 people in those 3 countries alone. That includes civilians and it includes members of the U.S. military and also, allied partners. It also includes militants because what we say is that a lot of times for political reasons, someone will die and they'll be counted as a militant when actually they're a civilian. So it's really important to kind of take that broader view. So 500,000 people, and those are just people who have died directly from, you know, bullets and bombs. Then you have to think about all the people who have died indirectly because of these wars and the fact that people will be displaced, right? They'll flee within their countries or outside of its borders, and they don't have enough, you know, they don't have enough to make ends meet. So then there's ways that people die. There's infrastructure that's destroyed, medical doctors and nurses who have about over half of the medical doctors and nurses in Iraq have fled Iraq since the beginning of the war. So it just has all these ripple effects. And what we say is that several times as many more people have died indirectly. So you're talking about millions of people in those 3 countries alone.
So we just have 1 minute left, but as you mentioned, $13 trillion of taxpayer money has been used to wreak havoc in the world with the U.S. global war on terrorism. And on February 6th, the House of Armed Services Committee finally held a hearing on the Pentagon's counterterrorism approach. Can you talk about the importance of this and if there is any end in sight to what has been an endless global U.S. war on terror?
The thing that is giving us a little bit of hope is that there is a little bit of momentum, especially in the new House of Representatives, around they're talking about the forever war, and they are they're holding these kinds of hearings. There is, you know, the Foreign Affairs Committee also is talking about increased oversight. Representative Barbara Lee of California has been, you know, she was the one person who voted against this war way back in the day. She was the one member of Congress, and she's still going strong and trying to get Congress to talk about this issue and to end these wars. And then there's people like Ro Khanna, also of California, who's a really a strong anti-war voice.